I'm John Kroll. Today, on the special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with Indianapolis businessman and philanthropist Mickey Maurer and Kurt Vonnegut Library head Julia Whitehead about her new film, My Friend Mickey. It's a documentary that tells the story of the remarkable life and career of Mickey Maurer. Because this is a recorded program, we won't be able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or through social media. But we do hope that you will enjoy this conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a recorded No Limits, so we're not going to be able to take calls or questions or messages via email or social media, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. We're going to be talking today with the people who are responsible for a new documentary called My Friend Mickey. It is about the life and career of Mickey Maurer. It's done by an old friend of the program, Julia Whitehead, who is the head of the Vonnegut Library here. And the subject is Mickey Maurer. They're both my guests. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much, John.
Hi, it's good to have you here. I would list Mickey's resume, but we've only got an hour, and I wouldn't have time to ask any questions. He is, though, he has been a philanthropist, a businessman, he is a lawyer, he is an author, he has served in public service. Just about anything that a person can do, he has done at one time or another.
What about the words has been? Is that has been, my career has is been. Over now?
No, it's just right now we're looking back. That's what documentaries do.
Okay. I feel like a has been as you.
So let me ask this, because it's a question. Most of my career I have been in the role of that Julia has here, where you're the person who gets to ask the questions and tell the story, you know, try to shape the story on this. But I've always been intrigued about what it's like to be on the other side of that equation, to be the one whose story is being told, whose life is being examined through another person's eyes.
Well, I would tell you it's embarrassing. And perhaps you don't know, but I told Julia that I forbid her to show this film until after I die. And, of course, she didn't pay any attention to that instruction at all.
Well, Mickey's mom is 96 years old.
There's a chance that all of them could outlive you, right, Julia? And you'd like to see it before they're done.
Well, so,
I thought it was an unfair request. Okay. I just completely ignored it.
So she must have got to know my wife, who completely ignores all my instructions as well.
Jeannie makes everything happen.
So let me ask this then, Julia. Talk to me a little bit about the genesis of this documentary. What prompted you? Because had you done documentaries before? Had you done film?
No, but I have been involved in biographies for years. I think you can take it back to when I served as a Marine Corps officer. I worked in an archives at the Marine Corps History Center in Quantico, Virginia. And, you know, then I went on to do a bunch of other stuff. But then I started the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library and, you know, got to learn the life of Kurt Vonnegut. I love biographies. That's something Mickey and I have in common. We love that. I always have. But then I, you know, the more I got to know the story of Mickey and the whole Maurer family, you know, going back generations, you know, I thought, wow, this is a story that I don't think people know. And I thought, well, hopefully I can be the one to tell this story.
And Julia's being a little modest because she also worked for Random House and she's got credentials. So she's very much up to making this film.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not saying that. I'm trying to figure out what, you know, with anything, what it is about a story that intrigues. You know, a friend of mine, Adam Hochschild, who's been a National Book nominee and has done some fabulous books, said once that the first question he asks himself when he's thinking about something is this a story or is this a person, if it's a biography, that I want to spend 3 to 5 years of my life with all the time and all of that. And he says, if I can answer yes, then I think other people are going to be interested too.
Well, Julia has spent about a year with me, and I'm sure she's sick of me.
Well, so, yeah, now I understand you want the gut answer.
Yeah,
how did
yeah.
this come about? So I had learned from Mickey's son, Greg, who is the keeper of the family history, you know, that family information. And it was at a period in my career when I was so focused on the business. We had a number of issues that we were dealing with at the Vonnegut Library, very important issues that affected our bottom line. And I was, you know, thinking about these things all the time. I wanted a creative outlet. And I thought about writing a book about Mickey because he is so fascinating. And then I thought, well, there are so many things about this story that would be better visually. And then I, you know, I thought, okay, well, I think I'm going to try my hand at filmmaking. I mean, Mickey made a film. If he can do it, then maybe I can do it too. So I reached out to different filmmakers after getting approval from Mickey and Janie Maurer. And, you know, their kids were helpful to me in coming up with photos and other things that I needed for the film. And I reached out to, like, Ted Green. And he said, Julia, let me tell you one thing. Of course, Ted Green, the mm-hmm. famous yeah. local filmmaker who recently created the film on Eva Kaur, the Holocaust survivor. But Ted said, Eva and I are best friends. We became best friends. Well, I'm not Mickey's best friend. Mickey has a lot of best friends. Mm-hmm. But I like to think that I've, you know, come to be close with the whole Maurer family. And they're even more special. That family unit is even more special than I thought they were when I went into this project. I underestimated what I thought I was getting myself into as far as contributing to this community. And so it's been such a fulfilling project for me because it satisfied my curiosity, my storytelling curiosity, but it also like confirmed or affirmed my you know thought or suspicion that wow, we got a really special family with a really great story to tell here.
That's very nice, Julia. But let's call each other best friends at least until I get to see the film.
You have not seen it yet.
But... I've not seen it in. Total. I've seen a few little snippets that she shared with me, but no, I have not seen.
Well, and I've only seen a rough cut because I gather Julia, you're still working on this,
yes.
as is often the case. You know,
yes.
with the documentary we just did on Dick Luger, I don't think we put a wrap on that until 2 days before it hit the air. So you're always tinkering right up until the last minute. Mickey, I want to ask, what made, because you are a public figure, I mean, you're a fixture here in Indianapolis and Indiana. This can't be the first time that somebody came to you and said, I want to try to tell you or your family's story. What made you say yes to this one?
Well, I generally try to be cooperative with any inquiries along any line if I possibly can. And so I want to be open and transparent and friendly. And the folks that... in your side of journalism, I try to cooperate. Being associated with a newspaper, mm-hmm. I know what it means when somebody doesn't return a call and isn't cooperative. So I try to bend over backwards to do what I can in that regard. But I have to admit, having said yes to this charming lady, that I am a little bit nervous. And I'll tell you why, John, a couple of reasons. Well, the main one is... some friends of mine who claimed that they said some nice things about me were told that those nice things are not in the film. Mm-hmm. And one in particular who said some nice things along with something that wasn't so nice was told that all the nice things were on the cutting room floor, but the not-so-nice thing has remained in the film. And he was a little distraught about it. And when he called Julia to complain, she said, look, this film... is not about Mickey's birthday party. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a real film showing both sides. So that's made me just a little bit nervous.
When do you think you will see it then?
I'll probably get to see it when everybody sees it at the
sneak peek
in the end of next month.
And that's probably a cue here, Julia. We ought to talk about the sneak peek.
Sure.
When people will be able to get a glimpse of it for the first time.
Yes. So that is on August 30th at 6:30 at Keystone Arts Cinema. And tickets are available at VonnegutLibrary.org.
How much to attend?
Just $25 a ticket. That is helping to defray the costs of actually making the film.
And yes. Popcorn's free, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, food and drink is provided as part of the experience.
As part of the $25 fee. And you plan to be there then, right, Mickey?
Oh, come on, Mickey. Janie's going to be there.
It'll be a surprise. Usually when you go to the theater, popcorn, it costs $25 all by itself.
So it does.
So it's a bargain. And I don't see how I can get out of it, but I'll maybe give it a half-hearted try. But
well,
I'll probably be there.
And Mickey doesn't know this, but this is a sneak peek, which will also have bloopers at the end. There'll be some outtakes, some fun things. So maybe some of those things that didn't make it into the film will be in the outtakes section of the film. It should be a lot of fun for viewers. Whether you know Mickey or not, this should be a good experience.
If you contemplated the equivalent of a director's cut or someplace where you can add some of that material that didn't make it in.
Yeah, and that's part of the plan. And also, Richard Lugar is our narrator for this film, and I had the chance to interview him, and why did you want to be, the narrator for this film? And so, we do plan to do that and include some of these extra special things. But if I may, John, I wanted to add, when I had the idea for this film and share that with Mickey, part of the reason I wanted to do it was because I was encountering people in this community, people I like very much, people who are social justice thinkers and others. And people had misperceptions about Mickey, and I didn't know him very well, but I knew him well enough to think to myself, I don't think that's true about him. Kind of some negative things. And
they're probably all in the film.
Well, I wanted to try to present the story so that whether you know Mickey or not, you get, as much of an accurate view of him. Because I had heard so many stories from people about ways in which Mickey helped them, whether they knew it or not at the time. We all hear the $35 million gift to the IU Law School and some of these other things. But I think there's this perception of, Mickey, kind of hard-nosed businessman. And I just, I knew a lot more about the family and the things that matter to them and their Jewish heritage. And I just thought that here is a person who is being misperceived in our community. And, I wanted to set that straight.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Julia Whitehead and Mickey Maurer about a new documentary that Julia has done about Mickey Maurer's life called My Friend Mickey. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or messages or questions via social media. So, Mickey, I want to talk with you a little bit about what Julia's saying. Some of it is because you are a public figure here. It's not an original insight on my part, but public figures often find themselves reduced almost to caricature in that perspective. What's it like at some level being reduced to a caricature, knowing that there are a lot of people out there who think they know you and have absolutely no clue who you are?
I don't come in contact with those people. I don't know. I've never felt myself being reduced as a caricature, but perhaps that's true. Maybe there's a number of people who are not happy with my body of work, but I'm a little bit surprised about it. I try to do my best at all times and try to be a good fellow. And when I was told by Julia that, hey, there's some folks out there that don't think as highly of you as maybe you do, I was a little bit surprised.
Julia, what's the biggest misperception about him?
I mean, I think it's just, tough businessman, maybe not, not the giant heart that he has. I'll give you an example. Mickey, when he went into the Secretary of Commerce position, he had to fire a lot of people. And, you know, if you're one of those people, you're thinking, you know, who's this guy? And but what I have learned and what, you know, Mitch Daniels and other people have shared with me, you know, it's kind of what I, in my own experience as a friend of Mickey's, learned was he expects people to try. Like, you got to try. If you're going to have a job, you don't have to be the best. You just have to show that you're trying. And so, you know, I don't know. I think that people just think he could be maybe focused on money. And that's another thing that I was able to dispel in my
research. I took that job for $1 a year.
Yeah.
That's not exactly focusing on money.
You need an agent. if you're just joining us. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Mickey Maurer and Julia Whitehead about a documentary that Julia has done called My Friend Mickey, which is about Mickey Maurer's life. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or messages or questions via social media. But I do hope you are enjoying the conversation. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today on No Limits, in this special recorded No Limits, with Mickey Maurer and Julia Whitehead about a new film, a new documentary that Julia has done called My Friend Mickey, which is about Mickey Maurer. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls or questions via email or social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So this is the other part of doing these things that fascinates me, and that is the tough parts of telling the story. I'm going to start with Julia on this one. What were the most difficult parts of sort of nailing down? Because this is, you know, I just did a documentary myself on Richard Lugar. That was another really crowded life. And there are some parts that are difficult to weave through and boil down so that you're doing it. What was the most difficult part of telling the story of Mickey's life and career?
Well, and, you know, I had a 3-hour film, and I thought that was a short version of the story, and now it's down to 90 minutes. But, yeah, narrowing it down to those major, you know, categories, those topics that you want to share, you know, just the process of that was, and also having to cut out some really interesting quotes or really interesting, you know, pieces of research if they don't fit into that that outline that I created. I think that's hard. I also thought it was hard. I wanted people to understand some of the, you know, the medical issues with Janie and Mickey, because I think sometimes with people of, you know, this status in our community, people just think, oh, their lives are so easy. You know, they can just pay for whatever, do whatever. But, you know, that's not the case. And so I wanted people to understand, wow, they're going through a lot of things. They've gone through a lot of things. And this is how they do it. Their family is a great model for how to be a family. But the film, I mean, like you said, it's not finished yet. I am still struggling with trying to get that story narrowed down to the areas that I thought were important, which include his upbringing, working in a junkyard, the family junkyard, as a 10-year-old boy, making deals with, you know, with adults who were not always nice, and, you know, learning that business and then going on to do the interesting things he did in his education and his business careers, and also the arts with his film and his beautiful book of fish and his various other books. I don't know. There's a lot there.
So, Mickey, what's the other side? What's the, you know, I mean, you have led a complex, eventful life. When that happens, for all of us, there are things that, parts of our lives that are more painful than others. Were there any parts of this story that were difficult for you to revisit? Or
no, none of them. I'm a very happy guy, very optimistic guy. I'm the kind of guy that jumps out of bed in the morning, can't wait to get my day started, sings in the shower, and never been really depressed about anything. When I have setbacks, and a lot of my folks are upset, et cetera, I just say, isn't this exciting? This is what we're here for. And so reliving all this didn't bother me. I would take issue with the word complex. I think my life is pretty simple, not complex. Maybe the only difference I have that from most people is I have a short attention span, which leads me to do a lot of different things. And rather, I mean, the good advice, John, would be to find out something that you do well and that you like to do. Mm-hmm. I'm talking business, and do it. Mm-hmm. And I do something I don't know anything about, learn that, and try to do my best with that, making a lot of mistakes along the way. And then when I'm comfortable knowing all that, I go on to the next something that I don't know anything about and try to do that.
I'm going to try to push through this just a little bit here because I get the fact that when you say you get a short attention span, you're trying to be self-deprecating and all of this. But part of the reason I use the word complex is because you have functioned at a very high level in a lot of fields. And one of the things that comes through in the film, and again, all I've seen is the rough cut, is that there is a really sort of deep desire. You know, it probably goes beyond desire for you to excel, to master new skills. Where do you think that, you know, you're the ultimate authority on this. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, a lot of it has to do with an innate curiosity. Mm-hmm. I am a very curious person and like to learn and keep learning, so I do like that. But then I will cite for you this inside me feel. There's always this little voice inside that gives me confidence. Somehow I have the feeling that I can do things. Mm-hmm. And accomplish them. Entrepreneurs need something like that because that's a tough field to be in. And there's this little voice in me that says, yes, you can do it, you can do it, and you can do it. Sometimes that voice is totally wrong, but it leads me to start and try new things. And so I have never been afraid to try something because I have this inner confidence that I can do it. I'm wrong sometimes, but I just feel that way going into a project.
So that inner voice, that little voice that you're talking about, where do you think that voice came from? And then when did you start trusting it?
Well, I believe that you should trust it as long as it's leading you to victory after victory. But I think I trusted it right away. And I think maybe a lot of my confidence came from the way I was brought up, but I'm not sure. I don't know where it came from. I'm not a psychologist, but I know it's there.
Are you given much to self-reflection on that? Or are you one of those guys who says, okay, this is the problem, I'm going to solve the problem, and then I move on?
Yeah, I like to be a problem solver. I did retire when I felt like I had accomplished the American dream, which is to have enough money so you don't have to work. And I did that, and I hated it. And that's because I wasn't a problem solver anymore. I turned out that I love to play the game of business. Mm-hmm. And I was very dissatisfied with myself when I decided to retire, thinking that was a good move, and it wasn't a good move. And nobody cared about my opinion that for that very short period of time. I didn't get much email or mail or phones, and there wasn't stress or anything like that I really enjoyed. And so I got right back into business, and I realized that it was the business I love. It wasn't the making of money. And when I got back in, I really give all the money away, and I just like to play the game.
Is the money pretty much just the way you keep score now?
Yeah, it's the way you keep score.
Okay.
Well said, John.
Okay. Julia, let me ask, because you've observed him and you've disappeared, where do you think that inner voice comes from? Where do you think the compulsion comes from?
I think there it is part of a certain personality type. I think I might also have that kind of personality type that, you know, as a child, you feel like nothing can stop you, regardless of your, you know, your socioeconomic situation, you will achieve your goals. You just have to work hard to make it happen. And you see that in his life working in the junkyard and, you know, at age 10 taking on these different jobs. There actually, if I could say a few things about some of the stuff he commented on, I would disagree with Mickey on his assessment of himself. I think he's very self-reflective, and I see that evidence of that because he will come back and say, you know, I thought about that, and I've changed my mind about this perspective I had. Or, you know, he thinks a lot. He is not one of those people who just makes a decision, that's the end of the story, move on to the next thing. Oh, he can make decisions quickly, but it's because he has already analyzed all of the data. You know, this one of the people I interviewed in the film is the astronaut David Wolf, who is Mickey's cousin. And I asked everyone to give one word.
He got all the brains in the family.
I asked everyone who I interviewed to use one word to describe Mickey, and David Wolf used the word perspicacious. And I didn't know what that meant. And so what that means is you can look at a lot of information, a lot of situations that have a lot of noise, a lot of extra information coming in, and to be able to zero in on those very key points to lead to the solution that will help you, you know, get out of your situation or take you into whatever goal you're trying to meet. And Mickey does that, and that's one thing. Another thing about the story that I think is really interesting, at different times I've heard Mickey say, well, this thing happened in the past, and I told myself, when I'm able, I'm going to do something
about
that.
You're anticipating my next line of questioning, but go ahead.
So the social justice piece of this story. That's one of my favorite things about Mickey Maurer, is his interest in social justice. As not just because he's a Jewish American, although I think it's really important that he is, because he sees himself in that minority community as a Jewish person, and always striving to raise up the justice for all minorities. I don't know. I think that is something I observed, whether it was discrimination or he told me the story about, you know, being in college and seeing gorillas at a zoo in Colorado. And someday I'm going to do something about that situation where that gorilla didn't have very much space. And sure enough, years later, when he was able to help fund that, he improved the life for gorillas in the zoo. I mean, that's just one thing of so many stories I heard, whether it's, something big like the law school or an individual's life. This gentleman who was coming out of prison after being held in solitary confinement and, you know, this very, you know, challenging situation he was coming back to. And he reached out to Mickey. Mickey didn't know him, didn't know anything about him. But he did learn that this guy was a pretty tough guy, and he still chose to take him on and mentor him and help him. And he's done that for 10 years with this gentleman who, you know, who has been out of prison for a while now. Actually, it's more like closer to 20 years. It's coming up on 20 years that they've been close. He's not the only person Mickey has helped out of the system or has helped to keep from going into the system, the law enforcement justice system. And, you know, those things matter so much. We're all so busy. It is so hard to take on another thing in our own lives beyond our own families, right? But Mickey does this every day. People come to his office. He will take, he said earlier, you know, he tries to respond. He takes those calls and he really tries to help improve individual people's lives. Okay, since I'm still on a roll here, let me just add this last thing. The fact that Mickey has not only owned his past of working in the junkyard, and that he and Janie, I mean, Janie grew up, you know, in Queens, New York, and, you know, she lived in not necessarily a great neighborhood. In fact, someone referred to it as the slums of New York. But Janie, I mean, she's just such a great partner for him. When you get to know her, you can see how they could build this wonderful life together and to raise children who are very much community minded and are not, you know, don't act like spoiled brats like they could, you know, in that scenario. They, you know, they're very, all of them are just very much community minded. And I don't know, they're just neat people to hang around.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Julia Whitehead and Mickey Maurer about the new documentary, My Friend Mickey. Sneak peek is going to be August 30th. It's about Mickey Maurer's life. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So I want to get back. One of the things that that struck me in watching the rough cut of the film is there is an episode in there where they talk about your mother, Mickey, not being able to play at Meridian Hills. And, you know, I think it's your sister who says that at the time you looked at her and said, you know, someday when I'm able to do something about this, I'm going to do it. And eventually, you know, you got some changes made there. What I want to ask is, what kind of feeling when you run into that kind of injustice, where does it hit you? Does it make you angry? Does it take you someplace beyond anger? Is it something different than anger? What is it? Because it's unjust. She was denied the ability to do that because she was Jewish. Which
that's clearly true, and that's Julia got that story correct. And I don't think I've ever gone beyond what you described as anger, but I certainly have been angry, and I've certainly made some decisions when I was angry, and I advise you not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that did make me angry, and when the time came, I was able to help mm-hmm. affect change, and now. That's no longer an issue.
Well, I guess where I'm trying to go with this is, you know, many of us get angry when we confront something that we think is unjust. But part of the problem with anger is it comes and it goes. To really push the change, I mean, you were willing to be patient for years for the opportunity to affect the change there. So there has to be a pretty significant motivator there. What feeling does it tap into when you confront that?
Would you ever want to see your mother cry?
No.
Wouldn't that be a pretty strong emotion then?
Yeah. So you could hold on to that
for
all of those years?
Yes.
So when you're thinking about that right now, where does it take you?
Well, I have a little bit of pride in the fact that we were able to face that issue when it was possible to do something about it. And so I'm feeling pretty good about how that all ended. But there are a number of issues, a number of situations mm-hmm. that arose some anger in me mm-hmm. that, again, I was able to deal with. And maybe there are a few still pending.
Okay. And we will have to pick those up, I think, in the next segment. Julia, in watching him, where do you think that drive for social justice or just to redress the balances here comes from?
I think when your father serves in the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II, protecting the world from fascism, you know, you and the fact that you're growing up in a, you know, a Jewish household, I think, I mean, here I'm speaking for Mickey, but Mickey is all American. He's an all American boy. And to be raised where, you know, this is your America, a place where you can help make this place a better place. And that's, you know, that's what he has done. That's what his parents tried to do. So I think it is that he has such high standards of how we behave in this country toward each other. And he's been able to see those advances over the years. You know, he knows things can be better than they are. And he knows that it is the responsibility of each person to go try to do it.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Mickey Maurer and Julia Whitehead about a brand new documentary, My Friend Mickey, which is about Mickey Maurer's life. It will have a sneak peek at Keystone at the Crossing on August 30th, Keystone Arts Cinema. And you can get tickets at the Vonnegut Library website for $25. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take questions or comments by phone, through email, or via social media, but we do hope that you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to this recorded version of No Limits. We are talking with Julia Whitehead and Mickey Maurer about the new documentary, My Friend Mickey. Julia is the creative force behind it, and the subject is Mickey Maurer. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the discussion. So I want to come back. You were saying here during the break, Mickey, the portrait that had emerged maybe out of your interest in questions of social justice might have been a little simplistic. Help me flesh out the complexity of it.
I think it might paint me as an angry guy, and I'm a happy guy.
Yeah.
And I'm not running around in my mask and cloak avenging wrongs. 99% of my day is not devoted to trying to figure out how to correct things. It's just enjoying my career. So we talked about all that, and we spent a little time on it, but I just want you to know that's not a very big part of my life. It does occur from time to time, and I'm pleased to see things that aren't right and do something about it, but it's not a major part of what I do.
Is it a source of satisfaction, though? Because that is one of the themes in the film, that because of your success in business and other areas, you are able to right some of the wrongs you see.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I'm certainly happy that I'm able to be in that position, but I do it because I think it's the right thing to do and not because I'm going to have any personal satisfaction. Everybody should feel the same way. If you have an opportunity to do the right thing, then do it.
So we'll go to the flip side. You say you're a happy guy. What are the things that make you the happiest?
Well, today the things that make me happy is family. I guess it's always been some, but I have more time to spend with grandchildren perhaps than I did with my children. It's funny. I got named Father of the Year with some organization. I forgot the name of the organization. My children were invited for me to get this award, and they all got up and said, "Are you kidding?" I hope they met in jest. I'm having a good time with my grandchildren and my children as well. So it's a nice time to be a kind of an old guy.
Yeah, one of the most poignant pieces, I thought, in the film is when you were talking about your father's death. And you said the thing that really hit you when you think about him is that he missed out on that experience of seeing his grandchildren really, really move through the world.
Yeah, I think if you lose a parent at an early age, which our family
did. He was only 53,
right? 53. It occupies your thoughts then as if he would have just faded out at 85 or 90. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it had a long-lasting effect. My siblings were younger, even younger than I. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's just an unfortunate situation for the kids and an unfortunate situation, as I said, for him.
What, in terms of the sort of satisfactions, and I'm gonna go with a vignette. I don't think you're going to remember this. But you and I actually were on a football field together once. My son was playing in a flag football game, and one of your grandsons was there.
I remember you, John. I remember
you were a really slow clumsy
guy.
You were
one of the slower players on the field.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember that, but it was over by North Central High School.
That's right.
And we
That's
had
right.
such a good time together.
But I remember watching you running around, and it was clear you were having the time of your life out
That's
there.
That's right. My grandson sacked me. Yeah, we had a good time together. I remember that.
So, where does what part of being a grandparent? Because it's clear, I think you talked about that with more passion in the film than you did any of your business successes or anything. like that, that was really, you wanted to be, and I'm going to use this word in the best sense of the word, you clearly wanted to be a patriarch, you know. And I'm not, I'm avoiding all of the negative connotations associated mm-hmm. with that word, but you wanted to be a father, you wanted to be a grandfather, a source of strength and support and yeah, counsel and to your children.
Who knows whether I'm doing a good job at it or not? You always wonder.
That's the problem with being a parent. You never
that's
know.
Right. You never know. I'm enjoying trying. I'd like to help my grandchildren with their essays or English assignments, and they've all now decided that I'm not allowed to help anymore because I make them go through four or five or six drafts, and they want to polish it off right away in one draft. And say, don't go to Papa unless you want to spend the whole evening trying to write this paper. So they don't bring me that stuff anymore. But I'm still around for math.
Mm-hmm. So, Julia, you said earlier in the program that part of what drew you to this was the devotion to family
the
sense
yeah.
of it, and that there were some lessons to be drawn here that, you know, that this might be a model for how a family could be constructed. What are some of those lessons that you saw?
Yeah, so, well, and to touch on what you guys were just talking about, I think one sign that you're probably a pretty decent parent is if your kids want to live around you. His kids all live right around his house. I don't mean, you know, across town. I mean they all live kind of together. They really enjoy each other's company, and the children, you know, love each other's company as well. But you know, I got to know his son, Greg, a little bit. One thing about Greg and Mickey, when you first sit down to meet with them, the very first thing they say is, how can I help you? Now, you think, well, that's kind of a common thing to say. How can I help you? That's not what these guys mean. They mean, how can I help you? You know, what can I do to help make your situation better somehow? And Greg, there's so much good stuff that I wasn't able to put in the film, but just about how these children, and I need to mention Janie here because she is mm-hmm. right there teaching these important lessons on how to treat each other well in life. And, you know, she talked about growing up in Queens and how, you know, she's growing up with African Americans and Catholics and Jews, and like all these people are living together and living well together and helping each other. And money didn't matter. I mean, of course, it always matters to some extent, right? But it was the community that mattered. And these, you know, these kids, Mickey and Janie and their grandkids, they all seem to understand just how important community is. And, you know, Greg also and Todd and Jill, I don't want to leave them out because they're, you know, they're very important to all of this as well. They all think that giving back to the community is something that's right there along with all the other things you should be doing in life, taking care of your family, you know, supporting your family, all that stuff. But the community part is something I don't see with a lot of families. They might do something here or there at the holidays, but it is not a daily part of their lives. And I feel like this family includes community as a daily part of their lives, you know, whether it's board service or you know, financially supporting something or giving advice and just spending time, you know, spending time and helping out an individual or an organization. The other thing is the helping family members, you know, like Mickey has helped his brother find a job, his, you know, sister find a job. You know, I don't know about your family, but I don't see my brother trying to help me get a job. Maybe other people do. It's just different. And I have wondered if the Jewish upbringing has anything to do with it, that sense of community. I've learned so much about Judaism through this experience, that feeling of, you know, you are a people. It is a religion, yes, but it is a people, and you take care of each other.
It is a community.
Yes, absolutely.
So, and just to amplify a little bit of what she says, yeah. We have a policy at the office that, and I have, it goes back, I'll tell you what it is in just a minute, but it goes back to where my employer, Gene Glick, I worked for about a year, asked me to get some very important information for a paper I was making for him. And I had to talk to some guy named Jackson on the south side of town, and I needed that information, and he wouldn't return my call. And I was exasperated because, Glick said, where's that paper? And I couldn't get the paper. I couldn't get the information. I couldn't get the guy to return my call. And this is in when my philosophies were forming. Mm-hmm. I'm still in my 20s. And I decided from then on, I'll return every single call. You can try to sell me life insurance. I'll still return the call. And I have, for my entire career, I've returned every single call. And I tell people who ask me about that. Now, we have an exception to that policy, and that is I will see anybody, and I will talk to anybody who wants to, but that does not include lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody asks to go to lunch, my assistant says, goes up and says, Mickey, lunch or no lunch? And I only have lunch with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're having lunch, then I consider you a friend. And if we don't know one another, you're not going to get lunch. I'll be happy to, talk to you and try to give you advice if you want and meet with you.
Yeah.
And there's no exception there.
Yeah.
But lunch is
a social
my time.
Okay, with your friends and everything. Yeah. Everything gets okay.
Have we had lunch, Julia? See, we haven't had lunch. Yeah. That tells you something about our relationship.
May have to change the title of the movie there, right? Of the film.
Yeah.
So how did you arrive, Julia, at the title, My Friend Mickey?
Well, I'll be completely honest here because it wasn't my first choice, and I received guidance from a number of filmmakers who said, Julia, you're not getting it right here. I wanted just to call the whole film Mauer.
Okay.
Like Facebook or something, just a one word, a clean title, Mauer. And my friend Dave Meyer, I think you know Dave. And, you know, Ted Green and others were saying, Julia, no, you gotta put some more here. We need to know what this is about. It's important to say that My Friend Mickey, Common Decency and the American Dream, is one of multiple films being created by the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library, which took this film under its umbrella. You know, I shared with the board that, hey, I have this idea. I'm just kind of working on it as a side project. And they said, no, if you think that's something that fits under this Common Decency film series, bring it on in. Bring it under our umbrella. So that's exactly what we did, and that made my life easier because I could do that as part of my daily job, you know. But, yeah, it's part of this great film series. If I can give a plug for next year. Next year is the 50th anniversary of the release of Slaughterhouse-Five, Vonnegut's masterpiece. About his war experience and some other fun stuff in the novel. But we have two films coming out next year. One is about Vonnegut's war experience and his time in Chicago right after the war and how that shaped his writing of Slaughterhouse-Five. And then we have a short film about how Indianapolis is celebrating the release of Slaughterhouse-Five that we're doing here with WFYI. So it's... that's how that came about, John. Back
so
to
it
your
came as,
question.
So it came as part of this, and they arrived at it. The title then is a reflection of your relationship with Mickey.
Well, no, it was really more of
we're
the
not
people.
Well, you
we're
just said they don't have lunch, but
no, we've had lunch before. We are friends.
Okay.
We are. We're good friends. But the folks who saw my outline and you know some of the. Interview clips I had already said, you know, all these people are talking about, you know, their friend Mickey. And that's another part of the film that people I interviewed, whether it's Angie of Angie's List or Mitch Daniels or, you know, all of these other friends from high school and childhood and on up, you know, to business partners. Mickey, you know, Mickey's a good friend to people. And it is not, I think people who don't know him or have a misperception about him, you know, don't see how he's such a good friend. But when you get to know him and he, you know, opens up a little more, then, you know, you can see that he's just a very kind person. He has a really big heart. And, you know, and Janie's just like that, too. They think about things that will help their friends. For example, one of the interviewees, he was in South America when his mother passed away. And Mickey and Janie made it possible for him to just immediately fly home to, you know, and that's something that he didn't think, wasn't able to do that or whatever. They just took all that worry or stress away or whatever and just quickly made it possible for him to, you know, to quickly fly home. And that stuff matters so much to be there for somebody. I heard so many stories about little things that matter, especially when it's a crisis situation, or even just a nice to do thing. That, you know, I was interviewing Will Shortz, the New York Times crossword puzzle mm-hmm. editor. And, you know, he talked about how Mickey said, "Hey, I'm flying out to New York. You know, should I bring your mom with me? I'm happy to do that if you want to see her." You know, and he just, that touched him so much, just that thought of doing something kind like that. I heard countless stories about that type of kindness.
So we're getting a little bit close on time here. I want to ask, I'll start with Julia on this, but what is the takeaway, the big takeaway you think you want people to get from seeing this film, the one that I just did on Luger, you know, the larger theme, in addition to telling the story of Richard Luger's career, was really sort of about the death of the American Center, the place where we could all come to discuss our differences and try to work through things. What do you think the core of your story is?
I'm not sure if I have captured it as much the way that I wanted to. But it has to do with a Jewish phrase, and that is, it's to heal the world. And it's, you know, so whether it's an individual life or the community or something greater, it's, you know, healing his mother's broken heart after being turned down to play golf at the country club, whatever. I think that's something important, and it includes family. Healing the world, you start with your family, but there are so many other, you know, layers of the onion is how I describe this. I'm not sure if I'm getting there. It's not finished yet, but I hope that's part of it, because that, you know, there's that Jewish message is important, I think.
Mickey, same question to you. What do you hope the takeaway?
Well, you know, I have not seen the film.
No, but I mean, it's your story. What do you? You've lived your life with purpose.
I want people to be entertained. If she said something nice about Judaism, I'd be pleased. It seems like there's a great deal more of anti-Semitism in the world now than there has been for many, many years, and particularly among the African American community. And in days past, African Americans and Jews were partners in a lot of what was going on in the 50s in the South, and there's no partnership today. It's just a very unfortunate situation, but not just the African American community. It's also throughout Europe. So if people come away from the film and say, well, those Jews, they're not so bad after all, that would be a good outcome.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Mickey Maurer and Julia Whitehead, for coming in here and talking with us about the new film, My Friend Mickey, Common Decency and the American Dream.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Certainly. It's been a pleasure talking with you. We will be back soon with live shows. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.